afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
Welcome to this session. I'm Ian Spring. I'm going to introduce Stuart, and then you're going to hear all about the Buchanites from him and his latest book, and maybe his new book as well. You might mention that in the passing, the one that's coming out in May.
Oh, do you mean the world's first ever walking football novel?
That's the one, yeah.
I mean, the geriatric train spotting, that one.
Yes, you could do that too. Anyway, as I say, I'm Ian Spring of Rhymer Books. Rhymer Books is a small publisher. We're a small publisher in Perth in Scotland. We're founded in 2020, so we've got 3 years. Two of those 3 years we've been country finalist for Small Press of the Year at the British Book Awards, including this year, which is very pleasing accolade. And we have 35 titles on the go at the moment, and a few more coming. So we have a fairly significant output. What I brought along today is obviously Stuart's book that he's going to be talking about, and I brought a selection of some of our other books, which I would like you to have a look at, please, if you have time, when we're finished speaking. And today I can offer you these books for sale, cash or card, £10 for The Woman Clothed with the Sun. And if you'd like any other Rhymer books today, half price, half the market price for you, especially for Kirkcudbright Book Week. Okay, Stuart is a long established author. I think he has about 7 books. We tried to count them last night, but you couldn't remember. Going a couple of novels, a couple of travelogues. He's also a massive book collector and an expert on Robert Louis Stevenson, and has edited the love poems of Robert Louis Stevenson. But today, this afternoon, he's going to speak about his novel that came out just at the end of last year, The Woman Clothed with the Sun. It is a novel, it's a work of fiction, but it's based on the true life story of Elspeth Buchan and the Buchanites, who some of you may have heard of. They were an 18th century sect who established themselves in Crockettford, in Galloway. And anyhow, you'll hear more about them in due course, and they're noted for some quite interesting practices and beliefs, and friends of Robert Burns too. Stuart,
thank you.
How do you go?
Good afternoon. I'll check first of all there are no Buchanites in the room, or indeed any descendants of the Buchanites. Good. Can they also check there are no experts on the Buchanites? And if there aren't, excellent. I have carte blanche to invent all sorts of nonsense. Which is quite a serious point in a way, because I want to point out the difference between the spurious nonsense that I've created and the actual fact of the Buchanites. So, interestingly, we came down from Glasgow yesterday. We're going past Irvine. A huge mist came down over the car, almost obscuring the road, and we looked to the left, and we saw about 40 people with hand carts. And we actually saw the Buchanites en route down to Dumfries and Galloway. So we drew up on the hard shoulder and looked at them. They seemed to cover all ages. Lots of children there, perhaps being taken along a little reluctantly. At the head of the posse was a woman in an amazing red coat riding on a donkey. And she was accompanied by a very, very impressive tall man who kept looking anxiously behind him just to check that there were no stragglers, or he hadn't lost anyone. Also, a funny little man at the front, just about 4'6" tall. Very odd-looking fellow, but we'll return to him. They were singing, not very tunefully, I must add, and they're very repetitive hymn, I suspect, of their own creation. So they did seem, as far as one can tell from that distance on the hard shoulder of the motorway, it did seem as if their eyes were fixed on a distant horizon, the precise nature of which we'll explain. And then the mist cleared, and I realised it just slipped back 250 years, so we continued our journey down to Kirkcudbright. Now, I think you are all Buchanites, basically. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You're pretending you're not, but clearly you are. And I know you've all spent a hard day working in the fields. Farmer Davidson didn't actually provide many tools for you, but he wanted the stones cleared from the field. You had to use your bare hands. So you're pretty sore, but you're not complaining. It hasn't been a bad day. The Lord Mother came to see you, as she does. Seemed in a good mood. And administered words of encouragement and praise to you. Sometimes she's not like that. Sometimes she seems preoccupied. She still has visions which can disconcert her. But she's friendly today. And mercifully, Hugh White, he wasn't there either. Presumably plotting something back in Buckenhall. Because he was rarely pleasant. And it's a good day when you don't encounter Hugh White in the fields. But now you're all you're around the table. Usual meal. It's remarkable what Elspeth Bucken can do with potatoes. But that is again the menu for the evening, potatoes. You know the pattern that these meals take. At some point, Elspeth Bucken will pick on someone in the room. That horrible feeling. Is he really going to pick on me? The rest of you think, whew, glad he didn't pick on me. So that was very much the experience that they had. She would choose someone in the room after the meal. They would stand up and she would interrogate them as to items of faith, or faith as interpreted by the Buckenites. But no, it looked, she was definitely optimistic, a good feeling in the room. Perhaps there's going to be a blessing. And indeed there is. We will act this bit out, but I'll let you know exactly when the good bits happen. So, we're going to have a blessing. I'll explain my sources later. But here we go. Elspeth stands up. Be not afraid, my children of Christ. Those of you who wish to join me in this sacred covenant, step forward. At first no one moved. Then Jean Gardner, a neighbour of White's, moved to the front and stood before Elspeth, head bowed and trembling. Open your mouth and receive the breath of Christ. The young woman closed her eyes and opened her mouth as if to receive the sacrament. Elspeth stroked the convert's face, ran her finger over her lips and blew gently into her mouth. The others jostled to be the next to receive this intimate blessing. Men and women, young and old, were treated similarly. White was the last to step forward. She breathed in his mouth before moving his lips onto hers. You are now brothers and sisters in Christ. You must embrace each other. Husbands and wives, do not hold each other. Remember our precepts. Our love is for all. Initially shy, the couple separated and found others in the group whom they held joyfully. So, right, up you get. Let's find someone else. You can hug and cuddle for the rest of this hour. Oh, dear. So, no sense of fun, basically. So, in that, there were several that she was renowned for, these strange practices. Breathing the Holy Spirit into people, and then they see the world differently. I mean, I suppose it's an interesting exercise in sort of mass hysteria, if nothing else. But we'll come to some of the possible explanations later. So there we are. So let's. There are two main sources. One of them is Joseph Train's book, The Buckenites from First to Last, which is written in 1848. Now, this funny little man that I mentioned at the along the edge of the train, that was Andrew Innes. A very odd-looking man. There's a picture of him, which Ian managed to print at the back of the book. And here is Andrew, just 4'6", something like that. See, his legs don't even reach the ground from the chair, with his astonishing stovepipe hat. But he featured very large in Elspeth Bucken's life. He lived in Mutt Hill, Fife, in Fife, with a very strange family, many of whom joined the Buckenites. And he first met Elspeth in Glasgow, on Glasgow Green, became totally, utterly obsessed with her, was the most loyal acolyte well beyond her death. And therein lies a fascinating aspect of Elspeth's life and death that that I will return to. So, what does Train say about Elspeth Bucket? Few females have acted such an extraordinary part on the stage of life as Mrs. Bucket. What I didn't say, I forgot it. Train lived to be, he outlived Elspeth Bucken by 50 years. So a bit of a spoiler there. She does die. She is not translated whole into heaven as she had promised people that she would. So if you're disappointed, leave now, but she does actually die. Andrew Innes remained loyal to her for 50 years. He's on her deathbed. She did say she would return in 5 days, 10 days, or 50 years. So the Buckenites waited 5 days, they were mourning. She didn't turn up. They could only assume this was because their faith had not been sufficiently strong. But they had another 5 days to put that to rights. They waited 5 days, guess what? Didn't come back. Andrew Innes waited 50 years for her to come back. He left instructions that on his deathbed he was to be buried above Elspeth Bucken's body, and there's a tale that, about her body as well. The theory being that when she did return to be taken into heaven, she would obviously wake him, and together they would ascend, which had been the thought that had sustained him through his entire life. Very, very interesting little man is Andrew Innes there. Right, so that distraction will never find me place now, but not to worry about it. So then Train says, yes, few females have acted such an extraordinary part on the stage of life as Mrs. Bucken. She gave herself out to the third person in the Godhead and pretended to confer immortality on whomsoever she breathed, and promised eventually to translate direct to heaven in a body without their tasting death. All who put unlimited faith in her divine mission. She also personified the woman described in the Revelation of St. John as being clothed with the sun and the moon, and pretended to have brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron in the person of the Reverend Hugh White. He was the tall person who accompanied her when we saw them from the motorway. Minister of the Relief Congregation of Irvine. Extravagant and blasphemous as these pretensions were, Our Lady found adherents even among the descendants of the pious Covenanters of the Lowlands of Scotland, who, renouncing every compact by which mankind is distinguished from the brute creation, left their homes and their relations to follow her in the delusive hope of escaping the common lot of humanity. From their name of their founder, these enthusiasts were called Buckenites. At the time they appeared in Ayrshire, the belief in witchcraft was not totally eradicated from the minds of the people. The singular tenets of this sect were attributed to the influence of demonic agency rather than to distempered organisation. Mrs. Bucken was supposed to possess such a proficiency in the black art as to cause any person on whom she laid her hand instantly to forget all earthly concerns and follow her, though it were to the utmost limits of the earth, with the most implicit devotion. But as far as I've been able to attain a knowledge of Mrs. Bucken's acquirements, it was chiefly by a wonderful volubility of tongue, well directed to the object she had in view, that she succeeded in seducing the unwary. So there we are. So more or less a contemporary account of how it seemed, given that Train got that from Andrew Innes. Clearly a utterly remarkable woman. Charismatic, no doubt about that. And I know her diet might seem quite irresistible, basically promising people no death and endless sex. But despite that, there were adherents and followers. However, so I think I read these as if they're fact, but clearly, how trustworthy are they? Have they been, influenced by the rumours and speculation that surrounded the Buckenites, indeed that surrounded all cults? Cults attract rumours, and it's usually rumours of astonishing promiscuity. Was that the truth or not? I have some other evidence, so we'll explore that a bit later. But yes, there were rumours and suppositions. I've added embellishments, which may be unhelpful in the fictionalised account. I've also put in pure fabrication. Now, what use is that? I suppose, I've dabbled in historic novels. But I've never actually grappled with the challenge of bodying forth real people about whom a significant amount, but not everything, is known. And I think that presented me with a constant dilemma all the way through writing the thing. I know the names of half of these people I'm writing about from other sources. I've been in their houses. I think it gives me, I felt, some sort of responsibility for their lives as I depicted them. I'm not certain I got that balance right, and hopefully you'll read it and decide for yourselves. I think I'd justify it by saying, yes, we know the facts of their lives, but we instinctively, as we read, we'll want to see them as fleshed out human beings. And I think our minds will wander and say, well, actually, who were these people? What did they think? How did they behave? How on earth did they all manage to live together in such a confined space? So hopefully, I've just given you my perspective on all these missing bits in the story. And I hope that I haven't done a profound misservice to these characters, most of whom I got to like. Well, the possible exception of Hugh White. No, I didn't get to like him. He turned out to be the villain of the piece. But there again, is that fair? What is the evidence that he was violent towards the fellow Buchanites? There is some evidence. But you know, you live with these people when you're writing about them, and you get fond of them. So anyway, so I think that'll be a theme of what I still have to say, trying to separate the fact from the fiction and the relationship between those two. It's quite a challenge. I'll probably fail with that. Okay, I did say I'd mention the sources. So what have we agreed? We've agreed that Andrew Innes, on his deathbed, spoke to John Train, whose sole claim to fame, I think, was the fact that he corresponded with Walter Scott and actually wrote a history of the Isle of Man, with which I'm sure you're familiar. So his book was published 1848, and then in 1904... John Cameron wrote a history of the Buchanite delusion. Basically, there's very little extra fact. It's written better. And yes, there are a few local sources that he's managed to call on. There aren't many sources. There aren't many records. I can only assume that that's because the Church of Scotland was the custodian of Scottish history. They certainly weren't going to spend time or effort perpetrating the deeds of alleged heretics and promiscuous livers around the area of Dumfries and Galloway. So we're dependent on these as the sources. So they're here if you want to glance at them afterwards, because I know some of you will be more interested in actually historic aspects. Okay, the facts. What do we know for a fact? Elspeth Buchan was born in 1738 in the parish of Fordyce in Murrayshire. I actually tried to find Fat Machen with a pal, and I think we did find, I think we found a pile of, because her parents were innkeepers, and I think we found a significant pile of stones at the point where it's very logical to have an inn, but that's as close as we got to actually tracking down her birthplace. Her mother died quite early on, and she was brought up by strangers, but again, I believe that was quite common in those days, particularly if the child had a particular gift that could be exploited by other people within the community. She clearly had a way with cattle. That seemed to be recorded fact. So she was lent out to farmers who had their cattle. It also seems that she had a reputation for visions as a child. Now, not a medical practitioner, but I believe that psychotic delusions are quite unusual in young children. Tends to be a later phenomenon that comes on with late adolescence. She certainly had garnered a reputation for for her visions. Now, she eventually went into service. I mean, she's very, very articulate. Yes, she was. There are lots of her letters extant, and some of them verge into gobbledygook, but there's sufficient there to make you realise a significant amount of education, you know, that she possessed. She did go into service, and it occurs to me that she might have been practiced on by the mistress of the house and taught to read and write or whatever. the mistress was courting a man who was a slave owner in the plantations, as far as we can tell. And he decided to uproot the entire household, while certainly taking the mistress and taking Elspeth Buchan with him to the Indies. So they set off at Greenock, and, well, obviously the ship sailed from. There was an issue with the ship, it was delayed, and it looks as if they're going to be there for another 2 months. And at that time, by all accounts, Elspeth left the family and started and embraced a life of wildness and pleasure with the sailors and the residents of Greenock. More of that or not? Fret not. She also met her husband, Robert Buchan. He was a potter from Ayr, and they married and went to live in Glasgow, where he's a potter in the Broomielaw. And then he found her difficult to live with. She would not abandon the pleasures of the flesh that she had evidently discovered in Greenock. So in despair, it seemed that Robert Buchan decided to take her north again. So back up to Banffshire, where she founded a dame school. And from what I can tell, the only qualifications you needed to run a dame school at that time was to be a marginally sentient human being and preferably a woman, and that was her sole qualifications. So she continued in her ways. Robert abandoned her, went back to Glasgow on her own. Eventually, the dame school failed, and I think again because of her lifestyle and the rumours that followed her wherever she went. So she went to rejoin Robert in Glasgow. She was becoming more and more involved in various churches. She followed preachers, she argued with them, she stood up in the middle of the congregation and took issue with some of the sermons. She heard rumours of a Hugh White, who I mentioned. He's the tall figure. He was the minister of the Relief Congregation in Irving. They corresponded, the correspondence still exists. And eventually she went to meet Hugh White and stayed with his wife and family, though they clearly were physically involved. But White's wife seemed happy with that, so already there's an interesting dynamic emerging there. They had prayer sessions in Irving. And you can still see Hugh White's house. You can see the garden, the Overspill garden, where they went for their meetings and their blessings. You can see the roofs where the urchins of the town used to gather for their sport and hurl buckets of excrement onto the believers in the gardens and such like. So basically, as was the case with Elspeth all her days, they were harassed and pilloried and persecuted and forced to leave eventually. And some initially 40 people, we saw 40 in that queue, didn't we? 40 of them left and travelled variously through, where did they go? Dundonald, Auchinleck, Skunkford, Condonnell, before resting finally at Cloughburn. So there they, bear with me. They were offered premises by Farmer Davidson, I referred to him earlier, in exchange for their labour. They worked for nothing. Hugh White claimed that he didn't believe in material resources, and Elspeth Buchan agreed with that. I think it's almost inevitable that Hugh White was getting a backhander from the local farmers who benefited from this tribe of people who were willing to work for nothing, ostensibly, and didn't ask for much in return. So he let them have a barn, and they slept on their heather beds in rows of two. They were pilloried out of Campbell Farm near Thornhill. They were the up before the Kirk session, before the press routine, before the poor law, got his grips on them. They were imprisoned. They were frequently attacked by the neighbours. So it was a hard life in that respect. But all the Buchanites at that stage maintained total, abject, uncompromising loyalty to this charismatic woman who was among them and on whom they pinned all their hopes for their current prosperity and their future salvation. So those are just almost the facts that we need there. Bear with me, almost there. So, I think we actually have to be clear who Elsbeth Buchan actually was. I mean, there were rumours of witchcraft, accusations of that. Was she suffering from some 18th century psychosis? Was she a genuine visionary? Not certain what that is, but it could be she had quite phenomenal gifts that captivated all the people who came in touch with her. As I say, charismatic. We know that she loved Lurgan tobacco, and I would often slide away from the others for a quick puff on her pipe. It's a lovely, ridiculous detail that somehow humanises her as well. As I said, I did get to like her more and more, to my surprise. Not just because of her promiscuous ways. I think she was happy initially with Robert, which I've tried to reflect in the novel. So this is quite soon after they meet. So we're back in Greenock. Elspeth became Robert's shadow, watching from the doorway as he raised pots from the wheel. She sang softly under her breath. Robert picked up the tune and hummed along with her. "I feel I'm being watched by an angel," he said. Intrigued by this idea, he fashioned several small angels from clay and fired them without her knowing, then placed them around the room where the pair of them met, or hid them in the bed where they slept. Elspeth cried with delight when she saw another angel hiding on the hearth or sitting in a recess on the lintel. "You see," she said, "heaven is jealous of our happiness. The angels have rebelled and have chosen to live with us." "I don't know where they all come from," muttered Robert, feigning annoyance at the graying host of small winged creatures. Elspeth loved Robert. The young potter swept her obsessions aside and laughed at her delusions. Her visions were in abeyance, replaced by the joy of immersing her life in another's. The ecstasy she felt was akin to the abandon she had felt for Christ, but her new Christ was real. She breathed the same air and they broke bread together. She became adept at digging the soft clay from the pit in the orchard. On one occasion, the cart overturned and spilled its contents. Hearing her shout, Robert left his wheel. Kneeling, he lifted the heavy clay back onto the wooden boards. Following his example, Elspeth too pushed her hands into the thick, cloying mixture. Their fingers touched, and Robert held a heavy grey hand and slowly lifted it up. Two hands then, swollen with clay, turning on each other, their fingers intertwined in a dumb show of strange birds, trying to take wing, but always held back by the other. Eventually, Robert's hand broke free, and he wiped it across Elspeth's face. She shrieked and ran into the orchard. So I think there were moments of happiness, but of course they weren't sustained. I decided, just my growing familiarity with her, or whom I assumed was her, that she must also have exhibited significant kindness to the Buchanites. And I think I've tried to evidence this with something I've made up. But what else can I do? You know, my instincts tell me she was kind. I feel it as incumbent on me to exemplify this. So this is when they're on their journey. As the Buchanites trudged on in silence, the sun sank beneath the hills, casting into sharp relief the gibbet that marked their entry into a new barony. Elspeth glanced back to check that there had been no more deserters and saw that Thomas Neal, they've just been expelled from Crockerford, had climbed the slope and was now standing close to the gibbet. She told White to keep the party moving towards Thornhill while she stepped into the field and walked towards the solitary figure. "My son, my son!" Neil stared into the past. Elspeth held him, but he stayed rigid, staring at the black frame. I saw him in the care, his hands tied. He spoke to me and spoke, but I couldn't hear his words. "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," said Elspeth beneath her breath. The chaplain man, he said some prayers. I had a knife. I was going to cut my boy down and help him escape, but the crowd was too big. I couldn't get near him. Then they whipped the horses and the cart moved away. Neil broke away from Elspeth and stood underneath the scaffold with his arms wrapped around the shape his son's twitching body would have filled had it been there. I tried to buy his clothes, but I had no money, and the hangman laughed, saying he fancied the breeches for himself. "I just wanted a minding, you understand." Elspeth lifted him up, and after wiping his cheeks with an edge of her shawl, blew into his mouth. "There'll be no more deaths," she said. "We've been chosen to escape the tyranny of death. His cold fingers will never tighten around our necks. His stink will never fill our nostrils. No more bodies on carts. No more crows picking at the eyes of soldiers on the field where they fell. No more widows crying into the night. Never again will the Black Death do Satan's work." "Look," said Elspeth, pointing the darkening sky where the last of the light played with the clouds. "There, your son. He's waiting for you." At that moment, the clouds changed shape. "My son, wait for me. I'll see you soon." Neil embraced Elspeth. "Thank you, mother. Thank you." So, I think that shows a kindly aspect of her nature. Now, given to visions. So, what indulgence to create a vision. Ah, carte blanche to write any nonsense about visions. Quite early on, well, when she was expelled from... It was the first expulsion from Irvine. The crowd wanted to throw her off the Stewarton Bridge. She did manage to escape them and found herself in a field in the dark. And she lay there overnight until she returned, bedraggled and clothes torn the following day to where they'd been staying in Irvine, where, of course, she was greeted like the saviour they assumed she was. But this is her crawling away from the crowd who wanted to drown her. She moved down towards the copse that hid the burn. Her progress was slow as she was snarled by thickets and pierced with thorns. The branches tore at her clothes and ripped what remnants of clothing remained on her back. She caught her foot in the root of a tree and fell heavily. She slumped against the trunk and closed her eyes. The visions possessed her. The devil was sitting on a rock tearing pages from the Bible. He then tore each page into strips and shreds that he dropped into the burn. As the holy words floated downstream, they reconfigured themselves into blasphemous sentences full of death and horror. Hugh White appeared, priapic, hands on hips, flaunting his nakedness at her. She saw her children holding hands and weeping as they walked away from her down an endless road until they grew tiny and disappeared into an insinuating cloud of dust. Robert was sitting at his wheel, on which she spun like a lump of clay that he shaped and raised with his fingers. Wet and slippery, the pot rose between his palms until it folded in on itself and collapsed. He swept the clay onto the spoil pile and wiped his hands on a cloth. Tired of casting sentences into the water, Satan approached, held her jaw, and blew his stinking breath into her mouth. She was choking, suffocating in the foulness. So she had her less than happy moments too. Now, was she promiscuous? Probably given the answer away in what I've said so far. I'm convinced they were, based on real memories of those who knew her, and also things that she herself said. So, in the early days, when she was back in Banff, working with her cattle, Train decided she began to be careless of the neighbours and the farmers' opinions as to what was proper conduct for a young woman. So what can that mean? What was she actually up to? So I have her in the field. She'd been tending the cattle. With each passing season, Elspeth grew visibly stronger. No longer was she such an easy target, but the boys would still approach her. On one occasion, the boldest walked right up to her, sucking on a piece of straw. "Will you kiss me, Elspeth?" "Of course," she said. "Fit, why would I no kiss such a fine loon as yourself?" She wiped her hands on the smock and then held the boy's face in her hands as if he were a fallen beast. The boy was too shocked to move, and his pals were similarly affected as Elspeth gently blew on his face and kissed him. His pals smirked with embarrassment and twisted their caps. After this, the boys' sport changed completely. Less likely to hunt in a pack, they'd make solitary journeys into the hills to find the wild girl who always seemed pleased to see them and make them welcome. They'd bring her gifts of sweet bread and sometimes small trinkets stolen from the drunken tinker lying outside of the tavern. Jamie brought her a tiny dog that he'd carved from a piece of driftwood. To his delight, she made great play of placing the token between her breasts and then gave him his kiss. When reunited with their peers, the bragging would start. Kisses became much more as the boys plumbed new imaginative depths. Mother Nairn, a twisted figure and font of all gossip, listened as her simple son regaled her with half-remembered details stolen from the braggarts. He became overexcited and lost for words, resorted to using the forefinger of one hand and the closed fist of the other to mime the deeds that his friends had gleefully described. Mother Nairn gathered her skirts about her, grabbed her son by the lug and pulled him down the lane in the direction of Geordie's farm, where she lived. So there we are, making a mark in her early days. And what about the debauchery or whatever went on in Greenock? Well, I have two unashamedly invented characters, James and Matthew, two lads that she actually meets down at the dock. They play quite a significant role in the book. They grew much more than I'd intended. They were initially just people that she met and became lovers with, and then they became jealous and she left them. But then they came back into my head and they came back into the story. And it gave me a wonderful opportunity to do some interpolation. Has nothing like a good interpolation. So we have the narrative of the two boys on their search up and down the kingdom, trying to find Elspeth. So if you can imagine a map of the parallel map of their journeys, they just miss each other by miles all the way. And the boys enjoy all sorts of astonishing adventures. They're press gang, they're imprisoned, they go down to Manchester to see Mother Lee because they thought that was her. I suppose for I think my writing is it's quite dense. I'm not certain what to do about it. It's probably the way I write. So I have to find ways of varying that. And I think my interpolations have perhaps helped with that because it's a different pace of narrative. And I hope the reader can just relax. Oh, it's the boys again. What are they even up to? And then back into the intensity of Elspeth. But this is the first time that we meet them. And again, it's this odd thing. I got to like them, and then they took over. You know, actually. So, is it appropriate to do that? I mean, will people read it? I tell them the very back what I've made up. I confess at the back. These are people that didn't really exist. Here are their names. Don't despise me. But it may be too late at that point. But that's the dilemma that I mentioned early on, trying to find what's appropriate and what's not. So, here we are. At the quayside, she stood back as two men, stripped to the waist, struggled to lift a hogshead between them. The short of the two stumbled and the barrel fell onto the cobbles. Its bung was expelled as if from a cannon and the thick black molasses spread across the road. Cursing, the larger man stepped into the cloying liquid to retrieve the bung, slipped and skidded face down into the sugar. When he managed to stop laughing, his friend fetched rags and attempted to wipe down his spluttering workmate. Without thinking, Elspeth joined them and took a rag to the man's matted chest. Surprised, he stood still and let Elspeth tend to him. "That's fine, lass," he said. Soon afterwards, the three of them linked arms and went into Leckie's tavern. The men introduced themselves as James and Matthew. "Christ's disciples," said Elspeth. "I didn't think so," said James, still smelling sweetly of molasses. Elspeth realised they were more boys than men, but was happy to let them tease and flirt with her. They were brothers from Glasgow who left home when their mother died. They'd worked in the rope manufactory until dismissed for drunkenness, but both knew that soon they too would join the long queue in search of new lands. "Meantime," said Elspeth, kissing James first, then Matthew, "let us enjoy God's gift of life." As the gin flowed, James became maudlin, declared his undying love for Elspeth, and fell asleep on her shoulder. Matthew sang songs until he failed to remember any more words and hung tunelessly. The brothers' lodgings, the spare space of a sugar store, were strewn with bedding. An old woman sat upright in a sea of rags and gestured. Two small children emerged from the same heap. James and Matthew had commandeered the far corner under the skylight. Elspeth sat between them on the nest of stacks, taking comfort from their warmth. Are you sailing soon? Asked Matthew, lighting a candle. The ship's delayed, but I'll not be going. I've got God's work to do. And what work might that be? Asked James, rubbing the back of his hand against her cheek. There's aye folks to be saved. They have to be made ready. What for? The second coming. What else? She lay perfectly still between the two boys. Look, she said, pointing at a hole in the ceiling that framed the crescent moon. As they stared upwards, she placed a hand on each of them. Neither James nor Matthew dared breathe lest she removed her hands. They both wriggled slightly and groaned. Be still, she said. Look at the moon. So they both become infatuated with her and dedicate the rest of her life trying to find her. And whether they do or not, you have to read to find out. But they do. Train comments that marriage did not cure her loose ways. And Robert, as I mentioned earlier, became heartfelt ashamed of her conduct. This was in Glasgow. What was she up to? What was she doing in Glasgow that aroused her husband's wrath? Pretty long suffering, old Robert. I don't think there's any doubt about. So there we are. I think this is the last salacious bit, so you can all leave after this bit if you want. But Elspeth was restless. Reluctantly, she accepted that a time had not yet come. Craving excitement, she frequently returned to the black boy in the Tron Gate. Whenever she crossed the threshold, the hubbub ceased as her aura filled the room like ectoplasm. Conversations faltered as all eyes focused on the tall, sensual woman in their midst, an apparition exuding the promise of carnal pleasure. The landlady, anticipating an increasing trade, once news of her return spread, rushed upstairs to prepare the room to which she knew Elspeth would soon retire in the company of her chosen companion. She was a gentle lover. She never chided the men for their over-eagerness. She never drew attention to their shortcomings. She flattered them, put them at ease, and where necessary, assuaged whatever guilt threatened to compromise their pleasure with her. She sang to them, crooning long-forgotten hymns that frequently evoked memories of them in more innocent boyhoods, which on occasions reduced them to tears. She revelled in their strength and ameliorated their weaknesses. She enjoyed their tales, encouraged them to talk of their families. Old George had survived several shipwrecks and swore they heard siren voices on a voyage to the South Seas. Jamie, having lost a leg in the war with France, was coaxed away from his inhibitions and persuaded to pirouette at great speed on his wooden limb. Elspeth clapped and laughed as the show ended with him losing his balance and falling heavily on top of her. Peter, the tar merchant, self-conscious about the black mud under his nails, was unable to perform. She held his shrinking manhood in one hand as it were a wounded sparrow and soothed his brow with the other. What ails you? She asked. It's no right, said Peter. I'm a married man. Jenny is a good soul to me in the beds. She's a fine cook and looked after me when I had the accident. What do you think of marriage, Peter? It's a holy state ordained by God. All fornicators and adulterers will roast in the reddest pit of hell. Do you really think so? She gave the sparrow an extra squeeze. Only non-believers tainted by doubt and racked by guilt will roast in hell. God wants us to live and enjoy the gifts he's given us. He wants us to be strong and overthrow this bondage, this tyranny that yokes people together in misery. Suddenly he relaxed, and the sparrow was transformed into a bird of a completely different feather. So there we are. That's Elspeth, one page on her way there. These are her own words. Marriage is a bondage to the flesh. It's a bondage to the flesh and is to be abolished. So marriage is a bondage to the flesh and is to be abolished. So there's absolutely nothing ambiguous about that. A direct quote from what she had. Okay, much of their time is spent in Buckenhall. Have any of you seen the remains of Buckenhall? It was about 8 or 9 years ago. It was still there. It's New Main's farm, and you can see it from the Thornhill Road. At least you could. Farmer there was very helpful, and he said that his neighbour discouraged people from visiting the ruins. He just wanted the ruins to fall down so he could reuse the stones. But I was able to enjoy a pleasing trespass and go into Buckenhall. Look, I even brought part of it with me. There we are. So that's where the inspiration or not comes from. Just, you know, just sniff the stone and the words come. However, it was quite amazing actually to walk among the remains of where these people live. Will, I need you now. Will, you have a job. Come on, measure the length of the room.
From the back, come on.
This one. So 13, 14 feet, 9, 15, about 16 feet here. So 30 feet would be another 5 feet beyond the wall there. So that was the. You've done well, Will.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think it's probably about 13 feet wide. So that was the extent of Buckenhall. 60 of them lived there. So 20 of yourselves, 3 times this amount of folk in. It was a 2-story building, but Elspeth and Hugh White, they lived upstairs. The king and the queen, White's wife and children, Elspeth's children, 3 of them went with her. 2 daughters eventually left. And the son left too, but he was killed at Trafalgar. It's a strange fact for you. But, you know, they obviously lived in some sort of promiscuous abandon. You can't have 60 folk crammed into this space without there being a small degree of wanted or unwanted intimacy among them. So I think that's a bit of evidence as to what things were like there. Yes, so they had several false translations. When they prepared themselves for the end of the world, they built a platform, they climbed on it, they sang their hymns, and then the platform collapsed and complete anticlimax, and White got really cross and angry with Elspeth, and she said, "You weren't ready for me." So that pattern was repeated for a bit. On one occasion, the neighbour's barn caught fire, and so they saw all the light and flames in the window. This was it, the heavens were open, Christ was coming to take them by their top knots and take them up through the clouds. Didn't happen. So they also, there was a farce. A fast. Allegedly for 40 days. One Buckenite testimony claims that they subsisted on air for 40 days. This seems marginally unlikely, given what we know of human anatomy at the moment. During that period, Elspeth and Hugh White, they certainly ate. And so I doubt if it was 40, a fast for 40 days. But you can imagine the tensions that would have created in that place when it happened. So I'm still on the facts, aren't I, of their life. 1791, she died. Sorry about that. 1791, 29th of March, she died quite suddenly. And this is where. You won't buy that book now, because you've given it all away. Doesn't matter. At that point, I don't think there was any doubt that Hugh White was developing his own ambitions that had nothing to do with being translated into eternal bliss, and much more to do with exploiting this acquiescent band and making money. He had lived in America. He taught at some marginally dubious theological college for a while, and it seemed that he was hankering for a return there. One of the Buckenites' testimony claims that a shout was heard. The Lord, what if the Lord Father is killing the Lord Mother, is murdering the Lord Mother. So he was increasingly violent. He was, after all, the person for the New Testament, who ruled with the rod of iron. I suspect it also became a helpful metaphor for the violence that he used to control the flock in Buckenhall. So, I think I have chosen to think that he played a part in Elspeth's death. Now, then I go back to my dilemma. What a dreadful thing to say about another human being who actually existed and I'd been in his home just for the purposes of writing a book.
So I felt a genuine guilt and unease about ascribing those motives to Hugh White. So I've skirted around it. I've chickened out, probably to avoid being persecuted by any survivors who choose to read the book and take me to court. I also make quite clear at the very back of the book that I have no real evidence. Anyway, you can see that for yourself. But I think his role in the narrative, in the fiction, points out that dilemma that I returned to earlier. I have responsibility for these people who actually lived. Although I think there's some evidence he was violent, how far did that go? So you'll have to read it and see what you think about the resolution that I've come up with there in the book. There is a witness to the Burns, the Buchanites' behaviour, and that is, of course, Robert Burns, who knew them in Irving. He was flaxing, whatever the verb is from... Well, what's the verb from flaxing? I don't know. He was doing what people do with flax, flaxing ship, huckling ship, whatever it is.
You've got it.
Hmm?
You've got it.
Yeah, a good huckling the ship. Good. That shed was right next to the house, separated by a small corridor, half the size of this room, which is still there, where the Buchanites worshipped, in inverted commas. So I'm sure young Randy Burns was more than happy to infiltrate to see what was going on there. Now, he did become involved with Jean Gardner, whose sister actually got pregnant by Andrew Innes, most unlikely coupling. However, that's further down the town. So, rumour has it that Burns proposed marriage to Jean Gardner, and there is a theory explored, I got lost in the detail, but please take it away if you want to see it, that it wasn't Jean Armour, who features in some of Burns' songs, it was Jean Gardner. Mm-hmm. That he had, he only went out with jeans so he could recycle the love poetry. So we have Burns' own account of what went on, and it's coming up. Very shortly. Sorry for this delay. I should invite you to talk among yourselves. Basically, here we are. This is a letter to his uncle, James Burness of Montrose. Their tenets are a strange jumble of enthusiastic jargon. Among others, she, Mrs. Buchan, pretends to give them the Holy Ghost by breathing on them, which she does with postures and practices that are scandalously indecent. They likewise dispose of all their effects and hold a community of goods and live nearly an idle life, carrying on a great farce of pretended devotions in barns and woods, where they lie and lodge together, and hold likewise a community of women, as it is another of the tenets that they can commit no mortal sin. I am personally acquainted with most of them, and I can assure you that the above mentioned are facts. So that was from Burns. So he obviously did feature. So Burns too has to feature in my narrative. I think enough people have put Burns on a pedestal without me adding to it. So I've taken the risk of upsetting Burns aficionados and standing up and shouting at me. A slightly different Burns here. He did visit Buchan Hall. We know that. Outside of the hall, Robert Burns stood on tiptoe and gawked through the window as the tableau of debauchery unfolded. This was not the first time he'd indulged his voyeuristic instincts. Irritated by his mother's assistance and to get a real job and stop fooling with all these daft-wee poems, he would frequently escape her nagging by visiting Closeburn, hoping to glimpse his Jean through the windows of Buchan Hall. He'd been pleased to note how over time the blessings had grown even more intimate than he'd remembered them from his days in Irving. He was delighted too by the indiscriminate nature of the couplings and the palpable joy of those involved. On one occasion he had been astonished to see two completely naked old women wrestling happily with a man big enough to be a blacksmith. He had even considered ripping off his breeches and bursting through the door to join in their happy endeavours, but had lacked the courage. But rarely had he seen anything like this. Jean Gardiner screamed, white opened his eyes and looked in the direction of the window at which he was pointing. Annoyed, he pulled up his breeches. His face, she shrieked. Relieved by this distraction for their mounting embarrassment, several of the men ran to the door and set off in pursuit of a figure running across the fields in the direction of Thornhill. Jean was inconsolable. It was him, she pointed. Who, dear? Asked Margaret White. She had especially welcomed the interruptions of the business between her husband and the Lord Mother. Him, the poet, with his white face and mad staring eyes. The men returned, their quarry having eluded him. They catch him later on. Give him a good kicking. Sorry about that. Burned the pissing on. So there we are. I haven't said much about Hugh White. How are we doing for time? I am riddled with boredom and desperate to escape. Yes.
5 to 3.
Oh, my goodness, that's ridiculous. I think Hugh White was endlessly cruel, and I have exemplified some aspects of that in the book. He was a theologian, allegedly, and he wrote this book with a most bizarre title. You can actually get it on print on demand, but I wouldn't recommend it. It is absolute gobbledygook. And the title of this book, in case you're getting on a books and ordering one this evening, The Divine Dictionary, or a treatise indited by holy inspiration, containing the faith and practice of that people by this world called Buchanites, who are actually waiting for the second coming of our Lord, and who believe that they alive shall be changed and translated in the cloud to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall be ever with the Lord, written by that society. Now, you know, I was hunting for a pithy title for this book, but I should really just have used that one. So, there's a lot I haven't said, but perhaps I haven't touched on infanticide. Because it's all right. I shan't. You can save on the time. There were rumours about infanticide, and rumours of bones being dug up in the fields I'm close by. Certainly, there's no record of any births there, which may find difficult to reconcile with the proximity in which they lived. However, I've also introduced, I mentioned James and Matthew, there's another character I introduced and made up, complete fabrication. A spy joins them. Alexander Gillespie, completely made up character. But it enables me to write differently again because he writes letters to his bosses. And initially he's absolutely appalled and gets quite carried away describing dreadful things that he's seen. It gives another opportunity to change the voice. But again, you'll be the judge of that. In fact, you'll be the judge of everything if you read the book. Thank you for letting me rant at you in a peculiar way for an hour.